Good afternoon and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show for this Thursday, the 29th of January. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling was recently convicted of a number of felonies under the Espionage Act for allegedly providing classified information to New York Times reporter James Risen about a failed CIA operation. Well, that seems pretty straightforward, but there's more to this conviction than meets the eye, according to my guest this hour. And we'll spend the rest of the hour digging into the Sterling case with Norman Solomon, author of a dozen books and co-founder of RootsAction.org and a founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Norman Solomon, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hey, thanks very much.
Okay, so who is Joshua Sterling and why are we really just now learning about his case?
Well, here's somebody who was one of the few African-American case officers at the CIA. Jeffrey Sterling joined the agency early on in the Clinton administration, and he was a specialist, as time went on, in Farsi about Iran, and he was the case officer for an operation known as Operation Merlin, which was implemented in the year 2000. You know, long story short, it was providing flawed nuclear weapon design for a component to the government of Iran in the hopes that it would lead Iran down the wrong path in terms of perhaps development towards nuclear weapons. And Jeffrey Sterling ended up indicted way later in 2010 on charges, as you alluded to, that he had provided classified information about Operation Merlin to the New York Times reporter James Risen, who devoted a chapter in his book to the subject, a book called State of War, published in 2006. So as I saw as I sat in the courtroom for 2 weeks, the CIA and the government was very eager to gain a conviction under the Espionage Act for leaking that information allegedly to Mr. Risen. And just a few days ago, the jury came back with a guilty verdict on all of the counts.
So, I mean, we knew about the Risen case before we really knew who Jeffrey Sterling was, because that was how this material came to light in the first place, correct?
Yes, not only because the James Risen book, which was a bestseller, and I must say very high-quality reporting, came out in 2006, but also because the Bush administration in early 2008 launched what became a series of subpoenas demanding that, let me say this a little indelicately, demanding that James Risen rat on his sources. Another way to say it a little more circumspectly is betray his sources for his book where he reported on Operation Merlin. And as a principal journalist, from that day to this, James Risen has refused to disclose any of his confidential sources for his reporting. And so, as you refer to, that became gradually a well-publicized conflict, and the actual person being prosecuted, Jeffrey Sterling, became almost a media footnote.
Now, Jeffrey Sterling had, as I understand it, filed a lawsuit or some sort of action against the CIA alleging discrimination. How does that play into all of this?
Well, it plays into it very directly because it's one of the two factors that earned a great deal of enmity from the top of the CIA hierarchy towards Mr. Sterling. In the early part of the new century, actually 2001 and 2002, he engaged in first a series of internal efforts to file a racial discrimination complaint. And when he got nowhere, he then, in an extraordinary measure, took it into the civilian courts. And the CIA did not like that publicity. He was profiled in the New York Times and People magazine and elsewhere. And just to sort of pull the thread there, eventually that lawsuit for racial bias, though the judge said there looked to be some possible merit to it, was thrown out of court because the government invoked a state secrets reason for saying there were secrets involved in his work, therefore he had no claim for adjudication. So that's one reason why people such as John Brennan, who at the time, a dozen years ago and more, was a high official at the CIA, now, of course, CIA director and very close with President Obama, was involved in it and clearly did not like what Sterling was doing. The second factor, which is very important, is that soon after being fired in the aftermath of his racial discrimination lawsuit, Jeffrey Sterling went to the Senate Intelligence Committee and met with two staff members to convey his concerns about Operation Merlin, that rather than counter nuclear weapons proliferation, it was so badly conceived and executed that there was a real danger that it had actually accentuated the dangers of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, in this case in Iran. And I think it's important, John, to recall that when this was going on, when he went in April of 2003 to the Senate Intelligence Committee properly, totally through legal channels, going from one branch of government to the legislative branch to an oversight committee, and also symbolically crossing the Potomac, this was just a few weeks after the United States had invaded Iraq on the pretense, buttressed by claims from the CIA, slam-dunk claims, that there were WMDs in Iraq. So one can see, and this came out in the testimony, that it was the current events that appeared to be an impetus for Mr. Sterling to go to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So this is the second thing, racial bias, and then this going through channels as a whistleblower, that had the opposite effect of endearing him to the CIA hierarchy. They were very mad.
And so that's why the prosecution was launched, because they were mad at him?
Well, I believe there are many indications that the finger pointing went towards him when, a few years later, in January of 2006, James Risen's book titled State of War came out with this incendiary Chapter 9 about Operation Merlin. And I sat through all of the testimony. I was there every day of the 7 days of courtroom proceedings that ended with the verdict on Monday in Alexandria, Virginia, in federal court. And it was very clear that when this story first came to the knowledge of the CIA, that James Risen was working on the story, the suspicion very quickly turned within the CIA to Jeffrey Sterling, and I'll explain why I think that is very suspicious from the standpoint of fair play. There was testimony about 10 days ago on the stand from William Harlow, the former press director for the Central Intelligence Agency, what they call the Public Affairs Office. And he testified that as soon as he learned from a phone call from James Risen that Risen was working on a story about Operation Merlin, and this began to get around inside the agency because Risen was calling other folks there, Harlow testified that he got a call from someone in the CIA who said, well, you know who was the case officer on Operation Merlin? It was Jeffrey Sterling. And Harlow testified that he immediately recognized Sterling's name because there had been this recent publicity about the racial discrimination suit. And Harlow indicated from the stand that that made him consider that, and this is my words, not his, but Sterling as a proven troublemaker, and it turns out then a case officer for this operation, that information about which has been leaked, the CIA suspicion and then case building turned in the direction of Jeffrey Sterling.
Well, even leaving aside for a moment the racial bias complaints and the lawsuit. Okay, let's leave that out for a second. If you when the CIA got the phone call from the reporter asking about Operation Merlin, it's not illogical for them to have considered who the case officer was if they were going down a list of people. Okay, who knew about Operation Merlin? And so who do we need to look at for the leak?
No, it's it would not seem illogical. Yes.
Well, I mean,
right,
it would seem that Sterling's name would pop up almost immediately.
It's not illogical at all, and yet we need to keep in mind that according to testimony in court by a CIA official supervising Operation Merlin, who they codenamed Bob S., we just got the last initials in the testimony, there were more than 90 people who were, as they say at the CIA, read into Operation Merlin, more than 90 people who knew about it. And the fact is that Jeffrey Sterling went to the Senate Intelligence Committee where one supervisor already knew about Operation Merlin. We heard testimony that there were people there who leaked out other information that ended up under the byline of James Risen in the New York Times. And so, you know, it has to fall ultimately, as it did in court, to the question of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And I've got to tell you that the entirely circumstantial case that was presented by the government raised many questions. And attorneys I talked to said that if the trial had taken place across the Potomac in Washington, D.C., rather than in Northern Virginia, where the CIA is located, then the results quite possibly would have been different. It's a very different jury pool. I sat there during jury selection. There were about 100 people in the jury pool, and the judge elicited from them that many of them had either worked at or had family or close friends at agencies like the CIA, the NSA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, as well as, of course, the Pentagon.
The initially, in the early phases of whatever, I mean, we want to characterize it as an investigation or what, but they were also looking at whether or not this material could have been leaked from the Senate Intelligence Committee. And in fact, there were at least some in the CIA who thought that was the most likely source. Isn't that true?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the FBI agent who's covered this for, well, more than a decade now in terms of investigation, who testified as a prosecution witness, a special agent, Ashley Hunt, said on the stand that initially she thought that Sterling was not a likely suspect. She thought that a likely source for the story would have been situated at the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I think we should also mention that this is very much a story about media, because when James Risen called the CIA and said, I'm working on this story about something called Operation Merlin, the alarm bells went off, and pretty soon they went off at the White House. And we heard testimony at the trial from then National Security Advisor and later Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that she convened a meeting at the White House on the last day of April 2003, which included some CIA officials and Jill Abramson, then the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, and James Risen. And entered into evidence was the text of the talking points that the CIA supplied to her, which she said she did not stray from. And she was very clear at the 15-minute meeting, she testified, we don't want the New York Times to publish any information. We want you to shut down your journalistic investigation. This would harm national security. And in point of fact, 7 days later, the message came back to the National Security Council office. The New York Times has decided not to publish. That was a decision by the top editor at the time, Hal Raines, and the publisher. And so for 2.5 more years, this story did not reach the public. And it was only when James Risen's book came out in January 2006 that the story was broken.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more with our guest, Norman Solomon, about the case of Jeffrey Sterling, CIA whistleblower, who is now facing possibly up to 80 years in prison after having been convicted of a number of violations of the Espionage Act relating, well, we've been talking about the Operation Merlin. This is a really odd case in a number of ways. And when we come back, Norman Solomon, I want to talk about the circumstantial evidence that was presented at trial and the actions of the judge in preventing Sterling's lawyer from questioning prosecution witnesses about certain aspects of their work. That's all to come. Wondering what you think about this, listeners. Were you familiar with this case? Had you heard about it before? Had you been following the Risen case or the Jeffrey Sterling case at all? What do you think about when you hear about cases like this? Why is this important? What's at stake here for you, do you think? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You can also reach the Kathleen Dunn Program via social media. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. Leave your comments or questions there. Again, our phone number, 800-486-8655. We'll return in just a moment for more of our conversation with Norman Solomon. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Today, we're talking about the Jeffrey Sterling case. Sterling, a former CIA case officer, recently convicted under the Espionage Act, faces a lengthy prison term. We're talking with Norman Solomon about this case. Solomon, the author of a dozen books and co-founder of RootsAction.org, founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. So, Jeffrey Sterling was indicted by the federal government, and he was eventually tried. Why did it take so long between the indictment and the actual trial? I mean, this is what, about 4 years, or at least 3 years between the indictment and the trial, wasn't there?
Yes, 4 years, and mainly the delay was because of this issue of whether the Obama administration would get away with forcing James Risen under penalty of going to prison to reveal his sources. And in a very strong show of integrity, James Risen has been clear throughout he would not do so. And in a weird twist, the Justice Department appealed the judge's ruling that Risen did not have to betray his sources to the Fourth Circuit, which overturned her decision. Then Risen appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which let the appeals court decision stand. So when the smoke cleared, the Justice Department obtained a ruling from the courts, which had been denounced by the New York Times editorially and many others, that says that journalists have no right to maintain confidentiality of sources, that they have a duty to betray their sources, in effect, although it's said differently. And one of the weirdest twists is that because of the pressure from journalist groups and activists, I think including our own organization, RootsAction.org, which in coalition with other groups accumulated more than 100,000 signers on a petition asking the government to back off, when the issue finally came to a head a few weeks ago, the trial was about to start, the U.S. government said, well, we have a right to bring Risen to the stand and ask him questions under penalty of jail, but we've decided we're not going to do that anyway. And so the government backed off, and frankly, in the aftermath of the Sterling verdict, there has been a fallback position taken by the Justice Administration, which is, okay, we won't throw journalists up against the wall on this issue, but we will redouble our efforts to imprison whistleblowers. And for journalism, and John, you were asking before the break, what's at stake? For whistleblowers and for journalists alike, when blowing the whistle becomes impossible, unless you want to spend a lot of time in prison on these issues of so-called national security, then the pool of information for investigative journalists will dry up, and that's very bad for democracy.
Well, there is no federal shield law. I mean, there have been a number of attempts to pass one, but we really haven't ever gotten one passed, have we?
That's right, and the only way that we've gotten shield laws in certain states at the state level is that, in effect, reporters have, when necessary, often engaged in civil disobedience. They've gone to jail. The state judges have said, okay, you know, give up your source names, and the journalists have said no, and the very spectacle of reporters going to jail has often shocked the public and state legislatures enough to enact some sort of shield law, but frankly, it's not in the offing at the federal level, especially now.
Okay, in the absence of a shield law, whether we like the decisions of various courts or not, and there have been a number of different decisions. It seems to me one of the standards is that if certain types of criminal behavior, I don't want to get into the weeds on this because that's an issue that we're talking about here, but. It's interesting that they decided not to go after the reporter in the end. Let me just ask you this. Did Jeffrey Sterling, was he the source of Risen's article? Do we know that?
After sitting through all the trial, I still don't know that. I would say that it's possible he was, it's possible he wasn't, and it's not only black and white. Many sources can lead journalists in certain directions, even about classified operations, without necessarily giving over classified information. But I would say this, in my assessment, his guilt, Jeffrey Sterling's guilt, was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is supposed to be the criminal standard for conviction. I think it's very important to note that 7 of the 9 counts that he was convicted on that went into the jury room were under the Espionage Act, which was made law in the hysteria during World War I in 1917, and the first U.S. citizen to be charged and prosecuted under the Espionage Act, under allegations of providing classified information to the news media, was Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers case in the early 1970s, and I spoke with Mr. Ellsberg yesterday. He's very upset about this conviction. He sees it as in the pattern of government trying to hide embarrassing and absolutely sometimes despicable activities and programs, whether war or certain foreign policy gambits, to try to hide that information, and when it fails, the hiding no longer works out, then to blame the messenger, in this case, blame and prosecute and imprison the whistleblower.
Let's talk about the charges that were filed, the indictment itself, because there's basically one thing that Sterling is accused of doing, and that is revealing the main charges that he revealed a secret that he wasn't supposed to reveal to a third party, in this case, a journalist. That's the basis of the charges. But there were 9 charges made. How do we get from one act and 9 charges? I know that prosecutors generally like to file as many different kinds of charges as they can in hopes that one of them sticks. Is that what was going on here?
Yes, I think that there was an overcharging strategy from the get-go, and that through one alleged activity, all sorts of permutations were added in, retention of this kind of information. There were separate charges filed and counts in the indictment and ultimately convictions based on what happened in 2003 when allegedly Sterling tried to successfully get James Risen to write a newspaper article, and that was separated from Risen eventually publishing the information in a book. There was stuff about retention of classified information, even though there was no real evidence he had done that. It turned out when he was finally subject to formal investigation, the FBI found a memo from 1987 that told CIA agents how to use rotary phones, and this is in the 21st century. That was supposedly terrible classified information that was found at his home computer. One other thing, it was discovered or alleged anyway that he had, after the investigation was underway, Mr. Sterling had deleted an email that he had sent to James Risen with a clip to CNN.com news about Iran, and that was considered to be obstruction of justice. So it you know, frankly, there were moments when I felt that Orwell was down the rabbit hole in a sort of a Lewis Carroll world.
And the document or the memo that you referred to about the rotary phones, that wasn't classified when Sterling took it home, but then it was later reclassified secret by the CIA?
Well, that's a key point. It was retroactively classified after it was seized by the FBI. And this very much parallels what happened in a famous and infamous case of Thomas Drake, a very high-ranking NSA official who was charged in a similar fashion. His home was raided, and then documents found in his home were retroactively classified, and then he's charged with retention of classified documents. And frankly, Mr. Drake might well be in prison today if not for the fact that Jane Mayer at the New Yorker magazine did a fabulous investigative journalism to expose on the eve of his trial just how absurd his treatment was.
I guess this smacks of ex post facto law, but it seems like there's a different set of rules when state secrets are involved than in other types of criminal investigation. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes, I think it is. Not only are the ton of bricks that are dropped much heavier in these areas that are called national security, but we have a tremendous problem of selective prosecution. When you have a Leon Panetta, known to as a former Secretary of Defense and former CIA director, giving information about the government's raid on Osama bin Laden that ends up being provided to a top producer for the Zero Dark Thirty film, when you have many other instances, some of them with the leakers identified, sometimes not, from the top of the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA, providing leaked information that is classified to news media, and nothing is done whatsoever. And yet, certain leaks that make the government look bad rather than make it look good result in these kind of prosecutions. One other quick example I'd give is that when the Senate Intelligence Committee report was released several weeks ago about torture, one of the passages of the report documented that the press office of the CIA was routinely leaking classified information to its favorite journalists about rendition and what they called enhanced interrogation techniques to try to make the CIA look not culpable and look good. Of course, the CIA did not file a crimes report on itself because this is routine activity. So when you step back, you see that selective prosecution with such extreme disparities involve targeting certain individuals, in this case Jeffrey Sterling, who allegedly provide information that people at the top of the government want to keep bottled up.
Well, and I guess, and I'm just going to play devil's advocate for just a moment. Regardless, forget about the law, it seems logical that the people who run the CIA would want to be able to control which information is leaked and which information is not. And I'm not discussing the rightness or wrongness or justice or lack thereof of that, but that seems like an expectation that you would have that the people in charge would want to control what information goes where.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a sort of a version of what, you know, has been described as the golden rule. Those who have the gold make the rules. Those who have the power are able to inflict punishment on those who are acting against the powerful. And I think that's definitely a key paradigm here.
800-486-8655, the number to call if you have questions. 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Jeffrey Sterling case. Sterling, a former CIA case officer who was convicted on 7 of 9 felony counts against him related to the Espionage Act. My guest is Norman Solomon, who is a founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, among other things. He's written a whole bunch of books. We had Paul sending in an email. He wants you to maybe expand a little bit about how the charges were built up and overly inflated. I know we have touched on that already, but we ended up with a 9-count indictment. And I guess there was one thing, and you mentioned this, but I want you to go back over this again. One of the counts in the indictment was that Sterling caused the Mr. Risen to write his book. How did they make that leap?
Well, they had a lot of very smart lawyers who were charged with making the leap and given a lot of fuel to do so. there were ways in which one action that was alleged was fractionated. For instance, okay, the government says this person retained the document. Then this person conveyed the document. Then this person encouraged the journalist to write about the information in the document. And then the year 2003 was separated from the year 2005 because the effort by Mr. Risen actually to have this information published by the New York Times in 2003 was thwarted by the Bush White House as well as the top of the New York Times itself. So it was pretty easy to get from one or three to nine counts when there was a determination to do so.
800-486-8655. We're getting some calls now. We'll get to those in just a moment. One of the things that kind of struck me here about this trial, you point out that the evidence was circumstantial. The FBI never found any documents related to Operation Merlin, and never found any direct evidence that that Sterling had ever had them in his possession outside of the CIA, or that even Mr. Risen had them. I mean, they never even found; they just couldn't find any of the documents, and yet they made the charge, and somehow or other were able to make it stick. That was kind of mind-boggling for me.
Yes, to me, sitting through the testimony for those seven long days and then the verdict, the way in which the entire government case was based on circumstantial evidence and how flimsy ultimately that evidence was just very disturbing because, yes, the government was able to prove that Sterling and Risen had phone conversations, but there was never any proof about what the conversations were about. And after all, Risen had already written, using Sterling's name, an earlier New York Times article about Sterling's race discrimination suit. And so a lot of conjecture was being called upon. And frankly, it didn't help that there were no African Americans on the jury, and Mr. Sterling is African American, and there was also a sort of a gap between understanding how journalism works and what I gathered from the voir dire and the selection of the jury. We could assume most of the jury understood. And so it was sort of a single source theory of journalism that was implicit in the prosecution that a reporter of Risen's caliber would have relied on only one source to write this major story that became a keystone of his book, which any journalist would know is absurd. And a journalist of Risen's character and caliber would rely not on one source, but on many.
All right, we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. We're going to take a break talking about the Jeffrey Sterling case with Norman Solomon. And when we come back, Norman Solomon, I guess when I read your story and the other stories about this case, it strikes me that the defense wasn't very effective. And maybe that's a mistaken read on my part, but I want to talk about Sterling's defense when we come back. We also have some calls and some email questions as well. We'll get to those in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the case of Jeffrey Sterling, a CIA whistleblower who was recently convicted of 7 out of 9 counts of violation of the Espionage Act. Norman Solomon, my guest, who is the author of a dozen books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And he's the founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of the of RootsAction.org. Okay, so at the trial, which was, I thought, pretty short considering the nature of the case, but at the trial, it doesn't seem like Sterling's defense was all that effective. Was there, I know there was at least one instance where the judge didn't permit the defense to say certain things to the jurors. What obstacles did the defense have, and what was your perception of the kind of defense that Sterling got?
Well, there were many obstacles, and I would say the defense was not successful. It tried to be effective. There were a couple of very skilled and committed lawyers, but it was running quite a steeplechase obstacle course where, for instance, the head of the press office at the CIA, William Harlow, and then later in the same day, former National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, were both being questioned by the defense about the context and the era, exactly what was going on when allegedly Jeffrey Sterling gave information to James Risen, when we know Risen contacted the CIA with the beginnings of his story over the phone, when we know that Sterling went to the Senate Intelligence Committee to spill some classified beans, as was legally proper, by going through channels. And what the defense was getting at was, as I alluded to earlier, that the U.S. had just invaded Iraq based on claims from the CIA about WMDs. And in point of fact, the defense asked Harlow from the CIA, gee, you must have been getting a lot of calls then when Risen called you, and I suppose a lot of those calls were asking, where are the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that the CIA kept warning about? And the fact that the judge kept cutting off that line of questioning, particularly protective of Condoleezza Rice, really ruled that context off limits. And I think that was very very tough for the defense to get past.
And one of the other things that you point out in your recent article about this case, the judge also did not permit the defense to reveal to jurors that several of the witnesses against Sterling had also brought classified documents home, this wasn't as big a deal as the prosecution made it out to be. Why? What was the judge's reasoning in not allowing that line of questioning?
Well, when we hear the judge, unfortunately, often it's, you know, ours is not to reason why. It's just handed down from on high. So when there's an objection and the objection is either ruled or sustained, that seems to be mostly the end of it. But I think the prosecution was successful in overall persuading the judge to have a very elastic sense of the parameters of the a case, so that when it wanted to go wide, when the government wanted to say, oh, this is terrible, revealing this information, and they didn't quite quote Condoleezza Rice that a smoking gun could become a mushroom cloud, but they quoted her to similar sort of stuff, then the government was allowed to go very wide. But when the defense wanted to go wide, quite often there was an immediate objection. The judge said, oh, well, that's not relevant. We don't want to hear about the invasion of Iraq, you know, despite that sort of a timing issue.
Okay, but I mean, the instance that I talked about just now, the idea, okay, one of the things that Sterling was accused of was bringing classified material home.
Yeah.
It would seem to me a very basic point of defense to be able to examine witnesses and say, well, okay, so this is a pretty common practice at the CIA. Why are we even talking about this? It would seem to me that would be, and again, I don't want to get into all of the legal details here, but that almost sounds like reversible error.
Well, you know, it gets down to, it's parallel to selective prosecution. It's implicitly, and the judge said this from the bench at one point, even if many other people leak this information, that doesn't let the defendant off the hook. If the defendant broke the law, that's what we're here to ascertain. And the prosecution was able to just to set those narrow limits. A context was that the CIA was presented throughout the trial by the prosecution and its witnesses, including 23 present former CIA employees, as angelic. The CIA is on the side of the angels, and when that is virtually presented as a rock-solid Mount Rushmore fact, then anybody who would raise any questions, even James Risen, was portrayed as a malcontent and a troublemaker, to doubt the necessity to just stay on the side of the angels.
800-486-8655, the number to call if you have questions. We have a question from Stu. Stu asks, if James Risen knows that Sterling wasn't the source, why isn't he saying who it is? Why let Sterling take the rap?
Well, this is an important and tough question, and I think here's a key answer. Any journalist who gets in the business of identifying affirmatively or negatively who their sources are will quickly plunge down a very dangerous slippery slope, because then the journalist becomes peppered with questions. Is this person your source? And if they've ever said no about one source, then if they don't answer in another source, that will be understood to implicitly be a yes answer. So the only safe way for a journalist to function is to say, look, I'm not going to answer questions about my sourcing, because once we go down that road, investigative journalism will be in a crash up and will be essentially demolished.
Let me stress this just for a moment. Yeah, go ahead.
A source, any potential source, whistleblower or others, that needs confidentiality to tell an unofficial story, needs to know that their identity will not be betrayed by the journalist. And this is just essential to the functioning of journalism that is not simply stenography for the powerful.
Well, and journalists have actually been successfully sued for revealing sources. There's case law there. It happened in Minnesota, where a reporter gave up a source and was successfully sued for having done so. It's one of those things where damned if you do and damned if you don't, at least from the legal standpoint. Let's take a call from Pat in Richland. Pat, go ahead.
Yeah, good program, gentlemen. The CIA, they don't have to play by the rules. That's why they win all the time. Have either one of you guys ever seen that film called Dark Legacy?
I have not.
I haven't either.
Well, it's only a couple years old. It was made in France. It's really after, like with the Kennedy thing, that Bay of Pigs that he didn't want to do, but the CIA was the one that got him in on that, and then he was mad about it afterwards because they had lied to him. In fact, he fired the head of the CIA. But anyway, look what happened to him when he said that he was going to do something about the CIA. The point is, this has been going on for a very long time. It is really a sad chapter in American history, but I don't know how it's ever going to change, really, because, you know, it's...
Sure. Pat, thanks thanks so much for your call. There are some questions about credibility here.
Oh, absolutely. And as the defense said in its closing arguments, quoting... I believe it's the Rolling Stones, the CIA is practiced in the art of deception. That's what they do. That is their self-defined job. And the credibility of many of the witnesses from the CIA during the trial, I thought was highly dubious, but it is the spy craft that they're in. And when it's turned, in a sense, against a whistleblower and a defendant, then it becomes highly problematic.
Let's take another call. John is in Milwaukee this afternoon. John, hello. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Thank you. Is the CIA's motto from chaos to order?
I don't know which mantras they're using these days.
Oh, okay. But you did talk about, the author did talk about that's like an Orwellian 1984 situation, that situation with that reporter, that ex-CIA guy. You know, we're getting into that ever more seriously as we evolve the technology and the control that the government can have. And I was wondering, what must we do to bring the republic back? Because if we're evolving towards this mind control and this terror, I mean, we're like Michael Hastings, that reporter got blown up in his car, and the author Philip Marshall was murdered with his kids and his dog, and okay. Things like that are constantly happening. There's
John,
like Sandy Hook
fraud, John,
we got it.
What could we what needs to be done to fix this is John's point, I think.
Well, ultimately these are political problems, and I'd say this as somebody who was a supporter of Barack Obama in 2008, but the fact is that Obama has bonded tremendously with some of the worst aspects of the CIA. He's brought in John Brennan to run the agency, whether it's covering up on renditions or torture, or whether it is the use of drones and certainly the witch hunt against whistleblowers, very pernicious, very dangerous towards democracy. So I urge people to take this on as a political problem, because ultimately the CIA is not a rogue agency, even if it is intimidating the person in the Oval Office. The leadership has to come from the top. It's leading in the wrong direction. And before I forget, I'd like to mention, this is, of course, a very complex set of facts and history on this case and beyond. And my colleague Marcy Wheeler, the investigative reporter, and I have posted many of our articles about the trial at exposedfacts.org. And I encourage people to visit us there at exposedfacts.org, and you'll get a lot of background information.
The by the way, next week on the Kathleen Dunn program, I believe a week from now at 2 o'clock, we'll be interviewing Scott Horton, who is the author of the book Lords of Secrecy. So we'll have kind of a similar topic next Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. The conviction on the 7 of 9 counts carries as a maximum of 80 years in prison. What is the what's the common wisdom on what sort of prison sentence Jeffrey Sterling is actually facing, and are his lawyers going to appeal his conviction?
His lawyers are planning to appeal. It's unclear that there's much legal reason for optimism on that score. At age 47, this is a very grim crossroads for Jeffrey Sterling, and while I don't by any means know the number range that is probable, I think there's an expectation it could be 10, 20, 30 years in prison.
Okay. There was a lot of support among journalists, of course, for Mr. Risen, who's one of their own. What has been, where's the support, if any, been coming for Jeffrey Sterling?
Well, I was very involved in, through RootsAction.org, the campaign to support James Risen, and we had core groups such as, based in Madison, Wisconsin, the Center for Media Democracy and the Progressive were with us from the beginning. The Nation Magazine, Freedom of the Press Foundation, FAIR, the Media Watch Group, and, of course, RootsAction.org. And then we got a lot of help from, as time went on, media groups, journalistic professional organizations, press freedom groups, all got on board, or many of them that we approached. But when it came time to do something similar in support of Jeffrey Sterling, that the charges against him, really as a whistleblower, be dropped, the same core group was solid from the beginning. But some of the press freedom groups dropped away. It was as though we will support journalists but not support the whistleblowers upon whom they depend. And so I would give a positive shout-out to the Government Accountability Project known as GAP, likewise Reporters Without Borders. They've been terrific in support. But we got a fall away from the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, a fall away from the Committee to Protect Journalists. And I think we're at a crucial juncture now coming out of this verdict where journalists need to speak up and speak out, and all of those of us who really want to fight for the First Amendment, to see that independent investigative journalism and whistleblowing need each other, and we can't throw either one of them overboard.
Well, it seems to me that the message for would-be whistleblowers right now is keep your mouth shut.
That is very much the message that President Obama and Attorney General Holder and the entire administration are eager to keep sending with greater and greater vehemence. And at exposedfacts.org, we have a secure drop there provided by the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We encourage whistleblowers to give information to journalists and to the public, and the reason is very fundamental. If you don't have the informed consent of the governed, you don't have democracy. We have an administration and a government in Washington that wants the uninformed consent of the governed, and that is not democracy at all.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Norman Solomon, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
K.P. Whaley produced this hour of programming. Lisa Nalbandian and Scott Myers handled on-air production. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about raising children in secular homes after the news coming up. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around.